Good morning and welcome to Autism Live. I'm Shannon Penrod, and we're going to be with you for the next hour talking about autism, but in the most fun way. We're going to talk about play, and I'm just doing a little light reading right now. We don't talk about this book very much, but today I'm going to refer to it several times. This book, it's heavy, and it's called Evidence-Based Treatment for Children with Autism, the CARD Model, and it was written by, look at this who's who in autism list, Dr. Doreen Grampiche, Dr. Jonathan Tarbox, Dr. Adele Nadowski, and Julie Cornack, all people who have been regulars on the show, and talk about things and having to do with how to treat individuals with autism by using a skill-based model where you teach them skills. And people often ask, like, well, how would I know where to find these and whatever? And we talk about the skills program, skillsforautism.com. But this is another route. If you like it all in a book, because in the back of the book, and I'm going to refer to this page many times today, they list the different curricula areas, and they show you what the lessons are that they teach. And so we're going to be talking about the play curriculum today and why that's super important. So, because play is important, but this is a step-by-step of what to teach at what level and how you move it up, and we're going to go over all that. Because I love to talk about play. Hey, I'm Shannon Penrod, and I am thrilled to be here with you. This is Autism Live, and the mission of Autism Live here on the Autism Network is to provide information and inspiration for that larger autism community. That starts with individuals who are themselves on the autism spectrum. I do not identify as one of those people, but I identify and what I try to be is an ally to those individuals to help them to be able to live the lives that they want to lead, not the lives that I want to lead. I just realized, Traven, I also don't have my iPad. I showed up today and sat down and, like, lost my brain. So I don't have your comments yet, but we'll get those eventually. But anyway, this show is about providing, as I was saying, to the whole community. It starts with the beating heart of the community, which is people who are on the spectrum. But then it includes all the people who love them and who want the best for them, that want them to be able to lead their lives the way they want to lead them. Not the way somebody arbitrarily decided, but how individuals on the spectrum want to lead them, who they want to love, where they want to live, what they want to do with the hours that they have on this planet, how they want to work. But I think that it's important that if we're honoring a person's soul, to acknowledge that everybody can learn, everybody can grow, everyone can strive. And striving is important, I think, for our time on this planet, because striving is about achieving, and striving sometimes is about not achieving, not hitting the mark that you set for yourself. And Dr. Phil always talks about it's important for a person to have a safe place to fail, because, you know, when we look at, for instance, Babe Ruth, who I know I'm dating myself here because most of you guys don't even know Babe Ruth anymore, but Babe Ruth was considered the home run hitter of all time until he wasn't anymore. The thing about it was, and he was known for being hitting more home runs than any other baseball player for a really long time, but he also, less talked about, struck out the most because he was swinging for the fences because he wanted the home run. And, you know, sometimes you have to swing for the fences and miss to get to the place where you want to be the home run king. So, as I said, Dr. Phil always says a safe place to fail. And play, I think, is the ultimate safe place to fail. It's a safe place to grow, and it's a safe place to fail, which leads to more growth. Traven sneaking me the... one of these days I'm going to make Traven be on the camera with us. We're going to have Traven's special day. I'm also going to say that don't forget that this Saturday we're going to be live on the red carpet of the All Ghouls Gala. Traven's going to be there. Maybe we'll make him be on camera then. With some amazing celebrities. Oh, I'm so excited, you guys. But we're excited to be there. Okay, so I do have the chat now. You guys can start saying hi. The chat is live. Today is Wednesday, October 26th. We are live. And we're going to be talking about play. So I hope you guys will write in and say good morning. Traven's going to show you all the different places that we're live and that we podcast. We're live right now on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and about a dozen other places. We will podcast later to all the different places that there are that have free downloads of podcasts. We want it to be free to you, right? There is a cost to us to upload to those podcast places, but we feel... Parker, good morning. We loved seeing your mother yesterday, Parker. That was so, not seeing her, but, you know, having her there with us. That was so delightful for me. That was such a treat because you're always a treat. And it's nice to, I say it's always nice to meet the moms behind the amazing people. You know, it's an extra thrill for me. So absolutely loved having her here with us. Erica says, how do you encourage a child with severe autism to play? We're going to get to that. All he wants to do is watch TV and play with his shoelaces or cords or chains, biting them, or playing with them with his hands. Well, first of all, one of the things that we're going to accept is that right now, that is his version of play. And... you know, we're not going to totally disavow that. That is how he finds enjoyment right now in play. So we're going to allow some space for that to grow within our hearts because people love what they love, right? But we're going to try to pizza dough that out so that we can find other things that he likes. And one of the first things that we do is take a thing that we know that they like and see what else is similar to that. So one of the first things that comes to mind is that my son, when he was little, somebody got him a box of lacing cards. And so Melissa and Doug makes a great version of this, you guys, because they're good wood, and it's basically a picture that has wood picture that has holes poked in it. And the box usually comes with several of them with several different laces, cords. And what you do is you take the lace and you have to push it up through the hole and then down another one and up through the hole and down another one. And he might super enjoy that. And, you know, I think play is about having enjoyment and de-stressing and decompressing, but it also is a safe place to grow, right? And when they're doing that and sewing, they're doing hand-eye coordination, they're doing the pincer grasp, right? All of this is good prep for writing. So he might be super into that. And then you can get more elaborate lacing cards. And it may be that down the road, we can be doing some crafts with him, like cross stitch and things like that, where he can make a picture by lacing things. We're going to talk about age-appropriate play. Parker, because Parker says, I know someone who is 30 on the spectrum who still likes Paw Patrol, and I'm concerned for him. You know what? I love that you're concerned for him, Parker, but that's okay. Watching Paw Patrol, I told the story the other day about how my grown husband got into Teletubbies and how I got into the Doodlebops. It's okay. Entertainment is supposed to be entertaining. If it's the only thing he's interested in, then we want to stretch it like pizza dough. And so right now he likes to watch the show Paw Patrol, but maybe we can get him reading a book about Paw Patrol. And then maybe we can get him playing a game that's a Paw Patrol game, like a match game with Paw Patrol. And then maybe there's a Monopoly game that's Paw Patrol. You know, there's a Monopoly game of almost everything. And so we go like this, and along the way we see if there's something else besides Paw Patrol that he might like. Erica says, I've started to take the TV away and only watch TV on weekends. I turn the TV on because if he is not watching it, he starts to mess with my stuff or climb furniture or rip paper or mess with my keyboard. And she says, okay, I'll try that. Thank you so much. Here's the thing. I want to tell a quick story, and then we're going to get into talking about play. A couple of years ago, before the pandemic, I had a doctor's appointment, and I go... and they have a waiting area for you to sit. You know, you check in now at the computer. So impersonal. And then you go to waiting area 34, and somebody's going to come out and get you, and it's, you know, there's nobody there to check in with, no human being to talk to. But here comes this dad who, it's clear to me that he doesn't spend a lot of time with his kids. And I don't know who the doctor's appointment is for, but he's got the two kids. They're like 8 and 10, a boy and a girl. And they sit down in the waiting room. There is a TV in the waiting room, but it's playing, you know, medical little snippets on the TV that really aren't to entertain anybody, but they're just information, facts, because hopefully you're not sitting there too long in the waiting room. So it's not very reinforcing or exciting or interesting at all, right? There's no storyline to follow. It's not going to suck you in. It's not meant to do that. I'm browning out. But the light just dimmed on me. I don't know why. But there we go. So dad sits down, I sit down, and the kids sit down, and I take out my phone, and I'm sending somebody a text, because I'm not just going to sit there and stare at my hand, right? I'm a person, and I've got things to do, and I want to be entertained, and, you know. So I send somebody a text, and then I go and look on my Facebook to see what's happening, you know? And dad sits down, and he whips out his phone, and he starts to, you know, do whatever he's doing on his phone. And there are the kids, 8 and 10, and they're, you know, they're this and they're that and whatever. And so they're not just going to sit there either. Like, not, I didn't do that. The dad didn't do that, right? So the boy gets up and he starts, you know, doing something with his feet, and he's got something going on, and he goes over and grabs one of the magazines, but he's not, it's a women's magazine. He's not going to, you know, he's a 10-year-old boy. This is not fascinating. So he starts hitting his sister with it, you know, and being like, come on, play swords with me or whatever. And dad's like, knock it off. Stop it. We're in a doctor's office. And I was like, oh, this is not going to end well. Because I took care of myself and gave myself entertainment, so I'm not bored. And he took care of himself so that he wasn't bored. Nobody took care of the fact that these two kids are sitting there. And what do they have to do? They have nothing to do. So they're going to find something to do. And they're going to create something, and it's probably not going to be something that's good. What's the thing that my great-grandmother used to say about idle hands or the devil's business or something like that? Because if people don't have something to do, they're often going to find something to do, and that may or may not be good, right? There are some kids who can entertain themselves endlessly, but that's not most kids, right? So when you say to me, Erica, that, you know, I put the TV on because if I don't, he starts messing with my stuff. Yes, of course. And so one of the reasons why we teach play, this all ties together, we teach play is so that kids know how to play, how to entertain themselves, how to move from one thing to another so they know what to do with their leisure time so that they are entertained. And if we can help them to direct it to something that's really reinforcing to them and maybe even beneficial for them, because they're learning skills, then fantastic. Because if we don't, you're absolutely right. Any kid, not just one on the spectrum, would come over and play with your keyboard because I don't have anything else to do. And it's sitting there, and I'm bored. And, you know, I believe in the 11th commandment, which is thou shalt not bore. And our bored kids will do anything. So, of course, you turn the TV on. Of course you do that so that he's entertained so he's not messing up your stuff. But of course he's going to mess up your stuff if he doesn't have stuff to do. What I want to put into your backpack is that there's more things that you could give him to do to entertain himself than just the TV, right? But we have to teach him how to do those things first. So we teach play, we exercise play, we use play, and do all that. And Parker says, that is why I learned to bring my devices to all of my doctor's appointments. Yes, we all do that now. We all do that. But when you're an 8-year-old kid and you're not on the spectrum, sometimes you don't have a device yet. Maybe you don't have a phone yet. Or I don't know with this particular dad with these two kids. But he got irritated with them because they weren't just sitting there. And I wanted to say to the dad, okay, let me take your phone away and you sit there for 20 minutes. And let me guarantee you, that dad wouldn't be able to do it. He would be up, he would be pacing, he'd be asking questions. Because none of us like to be bored. So let's just accept that our kids don't like to be bored either. So when we want to take them someplace, I used to have, my mom made me this zipper bag, and it was fabric that was all zippers. So you could open any of the zippers. Later she decided she was making one that each zipper had a different pocket, but originally it was just a zipper bag. Any of the zippers would have opened the same pouch. And in that pouch of things, we stuck a bunch of what I used to call two-minute toys, toys that would keep my son's attention for 2 minutes or less. And there were a bunch of them. There was like a little egg full of silly putty so that if he want, but, you know, that's a two-minute thing, and then, he, you know, he's done. But there were wind-up toys. There were all kinds of little two-minute toys, little fidgets things like that. And that went in the car always, so that if we went to a doctor's appointment, a restaurant, something, the zipper bag would come out. And the rule was one toy comes out at a time. You put that toy back when you're done with it, and then you can take another one. And that's how we would spend those times. And he would be interested. Then he got a Nintendo DES, and that was the end of that. And Parker said, when I was that kid's age, my mom brought my Leap Pad that I had at that time for that purpose. I'm so excited that you said that. I have a whole bunch of Leapfrog toys sitting just in my eye level because we're getting ready for Toy Guide, and Leapfrog sent some really good stuff this year. So we're going to talk about all those things. But yes, they have to have something to entertain them. But it doesn't have to be screen time. There are other things besides screen time. But screen time is very rewarding for our kids. I mean, let's face it, it's rewarding for us too. Okay. So anyway, I do want to say that I want to remind everybody, we have lots of experts on the show. I'm not one of them. Although I was told recently, listen to me, although I was told recently that maybe I am an expert in toys for autism, because I'm the only one who puts out a guide for that. So I don't know, maybe I'm becoming an expert in toys for autism. I would love that if I someday felt that I qualified for that, because I love what play can do for our kids. First of all, I love play, and I love toys, and I love playing with kids, and I love the spark, because I love teaching anything. And more than that, I love the spark of watching when somebody's learning. And I love when it's something that's fun. And I know for me as a human being, once a child, like, you know, toys open worlds of imagination for me. And it can do the same for our kids. We should always know that. So let's jump in. I feel like I forgot something, Traven. Did I forget something? No. But let's jump in, and so we're talking about teaching play today, and my whole thesis for you is that we want to teach play because it's worth it. And why is it worth it? Because it's that safe place to fail. And we always want our kids to have tons of opportunity. Remember, we talk all the time about what's the best teaching strategy to teach anybody anything. We know that it means giving clear instructions, giving tons of opportunity to try, lots of feedback, and that it should be reinforcing, right? If it's all those things, we're going to learn. Well, hello, play, as long as we teach someone how to use a toy, and part of teaching them how to use a toy is how to use it flexibly, right? So there's the clear instruction, tons of opportunity. Like, if the toys are there and you can do it over and over again, there's the tons of opportunity, right? But then the feedback, sometimes just the very play itself, I think this is why our kids love screen time and why they love video games, because the feedback is absolutely instantaneous. You either did the thing and you won, or you did the thing and you have to start over again, right? And that in and of itself is very reinforcing when you know I get another chance. And like the world didn't end because I tried to jump from this spot to that spot, but I didn't make it with my little character in Mario Kart. But I get to try again is very reinforcing for our kids. Plus the fact that, you know, hopefully the toys and the games are reinforcing. But one of the things that we talked about the other day is that this is not one size fits all. What's reinforcing to you in a toy may not be reinforcing to your kid. And you got to make room for that, right? Some people like the toys that make all the noises and have the bells and whistles, and some people don't. There's many companies like Leapfrog and VTech and Fisher-Price that have the adjustable volume on their toys. Love that. It's really important, because that sometimes is the difference of whether it's reinforcing to somebody. Now I'm going to have the hiccups. Good. Seems right. So we're going to talk about play. There we go. I think I skipped one. Okay, there's four basic types of play that we're going to talk about today. And then if you want to know all of the types of play, this is a great book for that. Evidence-Based Treatment for Children with Autism, the CARD model. Because it outlines it for you. But the four basic types of play that we're going to talk about today, because I see these as stepping stones that we can all get behind. That are easy enough, that unless you've thought of it this way, You wouldn't think of it this way, right? So we're going to talk about functional pretend play, symbolic play, imaginative play, and sociodramatic play. I have to say, oh, Parker, you can buy the book anywhere. It's on Amazon. It's big. You can use it as a doorstop. I'm asking you not to because there's good stuff in it. But you can. You can use it as a doorstop. And it's not the kind of book that you read cover to cover. It's the kind of book that you read and you look up a chapter and go, I want to know about play today, so I'm just going to read this stuff about play. And then I'm going to go back in the index. I think the index is worth the price of the book. Because in the index, it gives you all the lists of everything, all the curriculum and outlines. Okay, so here's what you would teach. And then there's a whole section that has just the studies. And there's a whole section that I don't use enough because I forget that it's in here, a glossary of all the terms. And there, you know why I don't use it enough? Because they're good definitions. They're not the convoluted ones that are in some other books. So there's nothing to make fun of. And I like to make fun of jargon that isn't understandable. We'll do that in just a minute. So functional pretend play, symbolic play, imaginative play, sociodramatic play. I started to say that I think the question that I'm asked the most having to do with play is the one that was already asked today. I don't know how to teach my child to play. They don't play in the way that I'm used to seeing children play. He makes a mess, climbs on the furniture, rips paper, or messes with my keyboard. And that's not how we're used to thinking of play with kids. But to me, there's a whole lot of clues in that. And we know a lot of people on the spectrum who like to rip paper, that's a really fun activity for them. And I will tell you that there's one young man, I wish I could think what his name is, but if you put ripping paper artist autism, I'm sure you will find his stuff. Because he's a very celebrated artist, and for years he would just rip paper, and his mother about lost her mind. And then, you know, he took an, I don't know whether he took an art class or somebody said, you know, let's see, you know, let's get him to make something with this ripped paper. And he does ripped paper mosaics. Stunning. Really beautiful stuff. I had a calendar one year that was all his designs, and I remember there was one that was like a parrot. It was just so beautiful, breathtaking. I mean, just brilliant. So this is why I say we don't want to get hung up on our ideas of what something is and whether it's functional, because you're going to hear the word functional a lot as we go through these definitions. But let's try to broaden our idea about what could this be. You heard Dr. Grant Pichet talk about, you know, when somebody wrote in about my child just likes to bang on things. And I know as a parent, you go, oh, this, like, how am I going to get through life if all my child is going to do is bang on things? But I'm here to tell you, and she told you guys the story of Logan Shepherd, who liked to bang on things and is now a professional drummer at the height of his game and celebrated. And, you know, so these things can turn into very... And I'm going to use the word functional here, meaning that it's something that is really helpful to the individual. We just have to be a little bit more open-minded about it. But so functional pretend play, symbolic play, imaginative play, sociodramatic play. And for me, these are the steps to getting to the point where an individual has the freedom. If you can do these four things, then you have the freedom to create. You have the freedom to create things that don't exist, visualize things the way you want them, and carry them out the way you want them. And I think that that's a brilliant gift to give our kids. And what we find is that not everybody on the spectrum, but many people on the spectrum have an innate artist sense about, you know, whatever the medium is that they like the kid who tears the paper and makes the pictures out of it, or Logan who drums and can write music, right? But and then there's we know other people that are fashion designers that can figure out how to make a skirt lay because it's something that they understand. They have a specific talent for that. So, but when you, a lot of our kids are very rule-oriented and rigid, and they have something called functional fixedness, that they, you know, there's a test that they have in psychology where they, you know, give people a hammer and, you know, say, what can you use the hammer for, right? And very rigid people will go, well, the hammer is used to drive a nail, right? But people who are creative will see that the hammer can be used as a pendulum, that the hammer can be used as a weight to balance something, that hammers can be used as a source of destruction, not just to build, right? They can be creative enough to see that a hammer can be the centerpiece of a floral arrangement, right? That because the rules can get fuzzy around creativity. So that's the other piece for this that I want to put in your backpack, is that when you teach play, you're helping to deal with stress, to be self-actualized, so that you're, you know, doing the things that you love and being free to be yourself. But you're also working on flexibility. And of course, you're working on social skills and problem solving, all of these things that play can do for you. So we're going to run through these four things, and feel free to write in any questions that you have about any of them. But let's start with functional pretend play. So functional pretend play, our actual definition, let's make fun of it, using lifelike objects in a purely functional, don't you hate it when somebody takes the word that's in the thing and uses it in the definition. So lifelike objects in a purely functional, socially conventional way. Socially conventional. Now I feel like I'm on a Handmaid's Tale. Way to imitate or act out common action sequences. What? I feel like that definition just has judgment all over it. Like, when I play, I want to play. I don't want to think, am I being socially conventional? I don't want to be socially conventional. I want to do what I want to do, right? So let's move on to our working definition, which is playing with toys that are lifelike in a lifelike way. So we've got the picture of the child there, and they have a plastic thing that looks like a camera, and I'm going to guess it isn't a camera, and that it can't really take pictures, although maybe it can, but not in the way that a traditional camera probably does. But it is a perfect functional pretend play toy. When we used to have big, huge warehouse toy stores, remember that back in the good old days? There was always one aisle that was devoted to functional pretend play. And I got to admit, as from the time I was a teenager up until I had a child on the autism spectrum, I didn't go down that aisle. And I thought, I was like, that's a ridiculous aisle. You know, because it has things like toy vacuum cleaners in it. And I would always be like, who is the person who is giving a child a toy vacuum cleaner? Like, what up with that? And, you know, first of all, because I didn't see very many people giving toy vacuum cleaners to men, so that, you know, that would set me off. But then why are you giving it to a little girl and going, oh, we hope when you grow up you can vacuum? What's that about, right? I hated that aisle. It was about, like, it has dishes in it, and even the little kitchen sets. I was like, ha, put tuh on this aisle. I didn't like it because I didn't understand it. That part of development is having that safe place to fail, and that pretending that you're washing dishes is a step along the way to your development of understanding the purpose of dishes and taking care of yourself and taking care of other people and having dinner and, you know, having a conversation over dinner and the roles that we all play. Like, I didn't really get that. And now I see that it is groundwork that our kids need to have. That one of the things we hear Dr. Grampiche say a lot is the ability to imitate is huge. When you have the ability to imitate what somebody else is doing, it's absolutely huge. And I recall, so I was not getting my son functional pretend play toys. That was not on my list of things to do. Certainly not before he had autism, not when he first was diagnosed with autism, right? But I remember I have this beautiful restored Saratoga trunk that my parents gave me, I think for my 21st birthday, because I'm originally from Saratoga. So that's a trunk that has the hump back on it. And it has these wood, it looks like a pirate's treasure trunk is what it looks like. But it has these wood strips that are on it that are attached to the trunk. And my son took a piece of plastic and he was taking and running it along the trunk, but he was doing it in the way that you swipe a credit card. And he was, I don't know, maybe one and a half, and he was doing that. And I was like, what is he doing? But it was very distinct that he was doing it like you swipe a credit card. And I told somebody about it, and they were like, oh, that's fabulous. He's watched you do it, and he's practicing doing it. Does he have a little cash register that he can play with? And I was like, no. Why would he have a cash register? I don't want him to grow up to run a cash register, right? We had, like, rockets and things like that. And they were like, no. But, you know, and this is really before autism. They were like, you have to let kids play out what they're seeing, that they play adults before they become adults. And you need to let them have fun with it. Then, of course, my son was diagnosed with autism, and they were all about, we need to get some functional pretend play things in here, because my son, when he was diagnosed with autism, he had been in the high chair and never graduated out of the high chair to sit at the table with us yet. So he was diagnosed at 2.5, and he was still sitting in the high chair because it was the only way we could contain him. If you sat him at the table, he wouldn't sit in the chair. He would get up and run around, right? And so the only time he would eat was when you contained him in the high chair. So, you know, they would make him play tea, and they would get the tea set out and pour the coffee and, you know, give you the plate with the pretend cookie. And we would, at that time, we ate at Subway a lot, and because it was convenient. And they had a backpack of, it was all Subway stuff. And he was familiar with Subway, and you could make a sandwich. And you know, and had the little drink and everything. And oh my gosh, he loved playing with that. I will tell you that I love all of the food functional pretend play toys that Melissa and Doug has, because there's a reality to theirs that I think is missing in other pretend play toys. Like, they have an orange that's a wood orange going to last generations, right? But it comes apart in segments like an orange and Velcros back together. And they have toys that have a play knife that they could never hurt themselves with, but they can practice cutting their sandwich. And the sandwich is magnetic or Velcro, and it comes apart. And oh, it's this Melissa and Doug, so good, so good. But that's what those functional pretend play toys are about, is a safe place to imitate what I see in real life. So now I'm a convert. I'm like, you know, do get your kids a pretend vacuum cleaner. My son was obsessed with vacuum cleaners. And we got him a vacuum, and, you know, he had a good time with that. So don't be afraid of that. I always tell people, don't spend $1 million on your functional pretend play toys, because you can, right? There are less expensive ways to do it than others. But do allow them, and they're very concrete things that, I just want to go over and grab 18 of them because we have a whole half of a studio filled with toys. But they look very realistic, but they're, you know, they're plastic. They, you know, and so it's clear that I'm pretending, but it's a great bridge to what we're going to be talking about next. So do a play meal with your kiddos. Have them cook in the kitchen with you. In their play kitchen, and you don't have to buy one of the big, huge ones. We've had before and showcased them before on the show that there's a company called Pop Over, which has these great things that go over a chair and makes a kitchen or an ice cream cart, and then it folds up. It doesn't have to take up your whole life. We lived in an apartment. We didn't have room for all that. I don't know about you guys. Okay, so then once you get the functional pretend play going, and you've got the dishes out, and you go, oh, I would like a hamburger, please, and your child goes over, and you show them how to make a hamburger, right? And then you have to show them. You go, I love eating it, right? I'm pretend playing. And then and it's almost like kids go, oh, is that allowed? Like, you see in their face, they're like, oh, I'm allowed to pick it up and go, I'm eating. And you're laying the groundwork for them, saying, it's okay. The rules around this are different than the rules around everything else. And our kids need that. So you have to model the behavior. You have to physically show them. I love getting a toy and sit down and playing with it, because then kids go, oh, I didn't know that's what that toy could do. Just like the parents do. I, you know, I love it. I tell you, I'm a big fan of Discovery Toys because they have toy parties and they demo their toys and show you how to play with them. And they have good toys. I love them. And you can, it's like, you know, you can have a party. It's like Tupperware. And then you save a bunch on your toys. And they'll show you how to use the toys, which is super duper fun. I absolutely love that. Okay, so symbolic play is the next one that we're moving on. Okay, with symbolic play, we're endowing objects with other qualities to play with them in a socially relevant and appropriate ways. There's that socially relevant again. You know, how put on the socially relevant and appropriate? Appropriate for who? I get really like about this because play should be play should be play, right? But these are definitions, and I'm making fun of them. Our working definition is using imagination to turn an object into a functional toy. And when I say functional, I mean like the functional pretend play. So walk with me on this a little bit. That let's say that, you know, the child gets a toy and it is a functional pretend play toy that is a phone. So it's going to look like a phone. It's going to be shaped like a phone, but it might be bigger. It might be brighter. It's got big buttons. It doesn't actually make phone calls, but maybe I push the button and it says, hello. Right? Something like that. That's the functional pretend play version of it. The symbolic play version of it is that I pick up something that is clearly not a phone, but I endow it with the qualities of a phone for the child. So I pick it up and I go, hello. Hi. Oh, it's for you. It's grandma. Do you want to talk to grandma? And then I hand the phone to the child. And the first time you do this with any kid on the spectrum, not, they're like, you're out of your mind. And often they'll walk away from you. And so what I do is I go, oh, really? Oh, that's so funny. You know, she just told me a joke. And then, you know, eventually you keep doing this and the child comes over and they're like, what? And then they want to hold it up to their ear and they realize it's not a phone. She's just being funny. And suddenly they want in on the game. Now, some of our kids are so rigid that they will reject that and go, no, stop it. Don't be afraid of that. Because you're taking their world of rules and you're saying sometimes the rules don't fit. And this is a really important lesson for them. Allow them to have their feelings. But you can go, oh, okay, he doesn't want to talk right now. And you put it down and then you move on to something else. And very slowly you start to massage their hard edges because they've been taught it's rule one, rule two, and anything else gives me anxiety. If we can start to loosen that up with toys and with play, that's going to help that kiddo with anxiety their whole life. Because we're going to start to ratchet that down, that it doesn't have to always, a phone doesn't have to be blue, right? A phone can be all different kinds of things. And we want to work on those things in a safe way. I'm not saying torture them with this. If they're saying no, 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 no. But you understand that they're having feelings about the fact that you're breaking rules. Let them have their feelings about it. Don't try to mitigate that. Don't try to change that. Let them have their feelings about it. I'm just saying don't let it be the be-all, end-all and go, oh, okay, you're having feelings. Let's stop, right? Because they're allowed to have feelings about it. We don't have to have the same feelings. We can be respectful of their feelings. But, you know, we can enjoy it still and do whatever, and they will eventually too. Okay, so you can take anything. You know, one of the things that I like to talk about is that, okay, you start with a car. Maybe you have a toy car for a toddler, and it's bigger, and you put it down on the carpet, and you vroom, 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 and you make the noises with it, right? And you teach the child, okay, and I always say, you know, use language and sounds as much as possible with toys to show them that it's okay. So that's why I sit down with a car and I go, room, 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 and do that. And usually if I'm teaching a child how to play with a toy because I don't want to bore them, I will introduce some form of conflict for them because that's what sort of brings them in. So I've got my car and I go, room, 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 and I go, oh, we're out of gas. We got to get gas right now. And then I'm going to go over and I'm going to take a pen and I'm going to stick it in and be like, oh, got to get the gas. Gas. Okay, I got gas. and away I go, right? And it might be that the car is a functional pretend play toy, that it is a representation of a car, right? But I used a pen for the gas cap. So I'm doing functional pretend play, but I'm also doing symbolic play. But the truth is that what I just showed you was imaginative play, because I didn't have a car. I just pretended that I had a car. And that's when we get to imagination. So we have functional pretend, where it looks like the thing and I play with it in the way that is the thing. Symbolic play, where it doesn't look like the thing but I still play with it like it is. An imaginative play, using imagination to create objects, locations, scenarios, and situations where they do not already exist for the purpose of play. Can you tell that I did this at midnight and I left words out? But our working definition for this is I'm making it up. I'm making it up. So I can say, this is a car. There's no car, right? And in the beginning, when you do this with kids, they're like, they want to see where, especially kids that are really are rigid, and they're like, where is the car? But you'd be surprised how quickly they get it. And they go, okay, she functions under different rules, and they think it's fun. Especially if you're going to do it with something that they like. Now, let's take just a second to talk about the fact that when we were little and we played, hopefully you played without rules and you just had a good time. And then life kind of puts us into these roles, right? Where we get used to doing certain things, and we need to be respectable, and we need to function by certain rules. And I think that, you know, one of the exciting things about, because let's face it, kids are a lot, right? And there are sometimes some days in some situations where it's just really hard, even when you're not dealing with autism, right? But I think one of the most exciting things about kids is that it reminds us about the wonder of learning something for the first time, and it reminds us that we can play, that at any point we can choose where our state of mind is and we can choose to play. So I always encourage parents, allow yourself to be silly. Allow yourself to let go of the rules, because what we're teaching your children is that they can let go of the rules too. Now, we're always going to have rules, and we're going to have safety things and things of that nature, but, you know, we can suddenly have very crazy accents, and we can read the book, and we can become an entirely different person, right? And kids, when you first do that, they're like, well, I don't know who you are right now. What are you doing right now? And in some of our kids, it will be a little like, and some of you might even find that the rigidity, like with my son, my husband could be as silly as he wanted to. He could be silly, silly, silly pants. I was not allowed to be silly, because then I wasn't mom. And that would give my son anxiety. And he didn't like it when I get really excited. There's something about the even now, the tenor of my voice, it's really nasal, especially right now. But, you know, he wanted me to be mom and not be silly. He would give me some exceptions when we were reading books, but I had to keep my voice at a certain volume. Otherwise, it would provoke anxiety. So, but Dad could get down on the floor and be an elephant and do this whole thing, and he, you know, and it was hilarious and it was fun and it was, you know, but if I did that, he would be like, no, mommy. Right? So our kids are going to speak to us about what their rules are around when we're silly, but be willing to try. Be willing to try and be willing to, you know, If it can't be you, let somebody else be there and teach them how to be silly, because they need to get their silly on sometimes. They need a break from everything. And they need to have that view of the world, that the world is not just black and white, that there are beautiful colors in the world. They need to get that sense as well. And we want to foster the imaginative play. And we can do this in lots of different ways, but be willing to be silly. I remember when my son first started therapies, and he had a speech and language pathologist, and she had one of those magnetic fishing sets. And so she taught, and she was very quiet and calm, and she taught him how to fish. And then she would, sometimes she would cover the fish with shaving cream. That was a real big thing in her speech. Other times she would bury them in beans, and he would have to squish around and find them. And then he could fish with them with a magnetic thing. Lots of different ways that she had him fish. And while he was fishing, she would be languaging it and say, okay, I want you to try, you know, you're going to catch the bluefish. She didn't know what a blue was, right? But she would language the whole thing for him, and he loved that. And what I loved was that there was one day when I just worried about, was he going to get the imaginative play? And we were working on all of these things, right? But it was about a year later that we went to Costco. No, it was Sam's Club, because at Sam's Club, they have, you can get a cart, or they have those push carts that it's a flatbed if you're going to buy a lot of stuff. And he loved it if we got that, because he wanted to sit on the thing, and they didn't really like that. But there was one day that I was shopping at Sam's Club, and he was sitting on the thing, and he was pretending, imaginative play, that he was doing the fishing thing, and he was catching fish and doing the whole thing and acting it all out. He was probably 5, and then he would catch the imaginary fish. There's nothing there, and there's no fishing rod, no magnetic anything, but he would catch the fish and he would put them in his boat. He was having a ball, and I knew that we had crossed a line, that he had, the world was open to him, and that he understood that things could be real, and things could be pretend, and things could be fake, and that he could sew that together to create whatever he wants. And now he's a writer. He's a screenwriter. So I love this sort of progression. So we go from, you know, one to the other. And then the last one that we're talking about today, which sort of seals the deal on all of it, is the sociodramatic play. Because this is when we bring it home. Now, you don't have to work on these like one at a time in a sequential order. You could start with sociodramatic play today, because here we are, and it's just a couple of days away from Halloween, and many of us are going to dress up and be other people for Halloween, right? And we're going to be asking our kids to do that too, and this is all part and parcel of it. So for sociodramatic play, the actual definition is play which involves the acting out of scripts and scenes inspired by real life, books, cartoons, and other media. Individuals take or assume roles using themselves and other characters, so they could use dolls, figures, and puppets as they interact together on common themes. And I just want to say, you know, what a way to suck the joy out of something by explaining it that way. I hate these, like, dry, that's as dry as a stick in Texas, right? That definition. Like, doesn't it make you want to run right out and do that? No. But I love, so then our working definition is make-believe or pretend play. And you're really taking on other people. Why is this so important? Well, what a great way to work on social skills. What a great way to work on relationships. What a great way to work on perspective taking. Because if I'm going to be the fireman, and I'm going to put on the fireman costume, then I have to at some point think to myself, what does a fireman do? What does a fireman say? Which is just a hop, skip, and a jump from what is it like to be a fireman? What does it feel like to be a fireman? What do firemen notice that maybe other people don't notice? What does a fireman think? Right? And that is perspective taking. And we want everybody, hello everybody, we want everyone to be involved in perspective taking, because that's when we care about each other. And here's the thing, you know, we hear all the time from people this lie where they say people on the autism spectrum don't have empathy. Lie. In fact, I think what we're going to find in the coming years is that people on the spectrum have so much empathy that sometimes it's hard for them to be able to pay attention to other things because they're feeling the feelings so deeply, right? And they can't necessarily language it, don't necessarily know how to make sense of it, but they're feeling it very deeply, right? What often happens with individuals on the spectrum, and it is not just individuals on the spectrum, the whole world has a problem right now with perspective taking. The fact that I'm thinking something and I'm experiencing the world some way and you're thinking something and experiencing the world in a different way, if I can simply accept that, I don't need to change you. I don't need for you to do something different, right? You're entitled to think things the way you want to and do things. If we had more perspective taking in the world, people would be nicer to people on the spectrum. So I want to make sure that I say this in a really important way. Everyone needs to do better perspective taking. But what we do see with some individuals on the autism spectrum is that they literally are not aware of perspective taking, this theory of mind that Sacha Baron Cohen always talks about understanding, and we can teach it to them. There was a time when we didn't know if that was possible, but we know that absolutely, individuals on the spectrum, if we introduce them to this idea and teach them about the fact that you think one thing, they think another thing, and that's okay, but we have to be mindful of it, that they get it, and they get it really well. Because they, you know, there are a lot of people on the spectrum that when you explain rules of things, oh, so what I'm thinking isn't what they think, then they just accept it, right? And then they act accordingly. So it's a really important thing. And sociodramatic play really cements that perspective taking. So I encourage you not only to do this with your kiddos on the spectrum, but this is how you play with the kids down the street that you want to be nice to your kiddo. Because if you're teaching them perspective taking too, well, you know, so they're going to play house. And the bossy girl always says, I want to be whoever she wants to be, right? And she assigns the roles. I love a bossy girl, right? Because they assign the roles. And then halfway through, they don't like it. And they're like, oh, I see that it's more fun to be the dog. I'm changing everything. I'm the dog now. You're the mom, right? But if we teach the bossy girl what's it like to be the dog, then, you know, if you're the dog, you don't want to be kicked, right? We're teaching her perspective taking. What's it like to be the mom? What's it like to be Bobby? Then the bossy gut girl who has all kinds of mad skills but maybe isn't so good at perspective taking, then she grows up to be somebody who's thinking about, just because it's this way for me is doesn't mean that it's that way for this person on the spectrum. Somebody says, my son is hard to pretend and focus on keeping imitation. That's okay. You know, if you're not to the point where they're doing a lot of imitation, take what you can. And there are lots of ways to teach imitation, but let's remember, it has to be fun for them. And there are a million and eight ways that I could tell you to teach imitation where it's fun. There used to be a game, I don't know if it's still available, but Cranium put out a game that was called Hullabaloo. And you could see on eBay if you can get one of them. They had two different kinds. There was like one that was a little console and one that was a DVD that you would put into the DVD player. And I liked them both, but I liked the DVD player better, because it comes with these tiles that you put out on the floor and you put the DVD in, and it was sort of like a kid's show, very colorful. And there's a guy on the screen and he's like, have you put the tiles on the floor? And, you know, I stand there with my son and I go, yeah, we put the tiles on the floor. And by the way, the therapist loved to play this with him too. And then it had this like shuffle thing on the DVD. And so the guy would say, okay, I'm going to give you 3 seconds to get on a blue square. And they would play music and it would count down 1, 2, 3 on the TV, and you'd have to run to a blue square. And then you look down at the blue square, and the blue square has an animal on it, and it would say, what animal is on the blue square? And it'd be a chimpanzee. And he'd say, okay, we're all going to be chimpanzees now. And you'd have to pretend that you were a chimpanzee and go all over. But the thing about it was that they would model the behavior, and there would be kids on the screen doing it too, so that if your child didn't know what to do, there was an example, right? And they don't have to do it perfectly, but it kept their attention because it goes quickly from one thing to another, right? So I loved that for teaching imitation. And there's all kinds of things like that. There's something now that's called, like, I'm not as hip to the new kids shows, but there's something called Go Noodle or something that's like that too. I have a list of these things somewhere. I'll find them. Max says, we had testing for our daughter today. They're on the fence with autism sensory disorder and speech development. Yes. And she's at stage one mild autism. Okay. Well, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a hug, Max, and tell you that you did something amazing today. That sometimes getting through the hoops of getting your child, I'm sure you're ready for bed right now, because I'm just going to guess that not a lot of sleep was had last night, worrying about how's it going to go? Is this person going to, you know, get your daughter? Are they going to understand, you know, what's going? Are you going to listen to what they say? Are you going to believe what they say? You know, how stress, right? So you got through that hoop. Okay. Now it sounds like from what you're saying that you have autism stage one diagnosis. So I know that there was a time and a place when we all would have said, come here, let me give you a hug, I'm so sorry. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say congratulations, because she is the exact same child she was yesterday, but now you have a new path to helping her. So congratulations on that. And also, it's wonderful that she got diagnosed with a stage one. But here is my biggest fear for you. That by definition, let's go over, and Dr. Grampuchet went over these yesterday, but, you know, there's supposed to be two numbers, and very likely she's a 1-1, right? But check it, because she might be a 1-2. There might be one area where she needs a little bit more. But 3 means they need a lot of support. 2 means they need significant support, but not as much as the lot of support. And 1 means that they need less support. But the very definition of the 1 includes in it that they need support. And the problem that I see with the medical field is that people go, oh, congratulations, your child got a mild, a 1. So you don't have to do all the things that everybody else is doing. You don't need to do ABA. You don't need to do anything intensively. Let's just see how things go. And that is wrong. If you read all of the science would tell you unequivocally that is the wrong tactic. And the very definition of the one needs support. And so when they poo-poo that and say, she doesn't need as much, she doesn't need anything, they're really cheating you and her. So what the science shows, and if you want to write to me, I'll be happy to send you the science. What the science shows is that those children stand the best chance to make the most progress. So, and Traven's putting my email on the screen for you. Those of you who are listening, it's shannon@autism-live.com. So Shannon, S-H-A-N-N-O-N, at autism, I think you all know how to spell that. And then there's a hyphen or a dash, and then live, L-I-V as in Victor, E.com. So, you know, if you look at the science shows that even kids who don't get a 1 sometimes make such huge strides that eventually they cannot be diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. I shared yesterday that my son was considered moderate to severe, so he would not have been a 1, and my son doesn't qualify for a disorder anymore. So I'm not saying that only the 1s can get there, but statistically, the 1s have the best chance. They have less they have to catch up on. But 1 means they need support. Don't skimp. And the science shows that early intensive behavioral intervention is the most effective. But I want to put everything in your cart all at the same time. I want to make sure that she's healthy. I want to make sure that she's getting good rest and sleep. I want to make sure that she's engaged educationally in all the things that she does. I don't know how old she is. But I really want her to get access to good ABA. And the science shows, I don't know how old she is, but if she's 3 to 5, the prescription is 40 hours of ABA a week. Now, most people are going to tell you with a level 1, she doesn't need that. She doesn't need that. But what they're saying is, oh, if we were to translate this into something else and say she broke her leg, but she didn't break it badly, so let's not give her a cast. It'll probably work itself out. We would go, that's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, right? Of course she needs a cast. The leg is broken. Now, autism is not a broken leg. Autism means that her brain was busy doing some things and she didn't pick up some things along the way. She's probably a little bit behind in certain things, not all things, but, you know, I'm guessing because, you might be writing in. They were little rubber tiles, Max, or Parker. Max hasn't written back in. But let's say that she is four, and, you know, and she might be talking, which is great, right? That's, anytime we have a skill, we go, yay, that's wonderful. But if she's got a level one, it might be that she's only talking in monologue and not in conversation. Anything that we do when they're little, we really, every kiddo is different, and I don't want to say I get in so much trouble if I say everybody between the ages of 3 and 5 should have 40 hours, because everybody goes, that doesn't take in, that's cookie cutter, it doesn't take into account the individual. Well, I think that's BS, but I will explain what I mean, that what we're saying is that this child is likely behind in some skills. And at 4, they have more time than they're ever going to have in the rest of their life, and their brain is more flexible than it's ever going to be in their life. And we have a real opportunity, and the science shows that this is the time to intervene and to do it intensively. And the science shows clearly 25 to 40 hours and the closer to 40. And really, it isn't just that. Because if we take into account what the studies have shown was that it was 40 hours of intensive therapy that involved play, and that after that, the parents were doing it at home. My son had 40 hours of intensive ABA, but he had ABA all the way around the clock because me and my husband were learning how to do it. And maybe we weren't doing it as well as they did some of the time, but we were learning how to do it. And what we were doing was making his every waking hour an educationally enriched environment. That's what's shown to be the most effective. So I hope, Max, that they're not going to skimp out on you and tell you she's doing so good she doesn't need stuff. Because I will tell you what happens when that happens is that, you know, she does well and whatever, but then she's going to be 12 years old and you're going to hit a wall where she doesn't know how to get along with the mean girls and she doesn't know how to help herself self-regulate. And you have a real opportunity now to intervene now, put those things in her backpack so that you don't have to come back for more when she's 12. If you have to come back for more when she's 12, 13, you will, right? But I would rather give her all the skills that she needs, get her caught up. That's really the thing. Get her caught up so that she never has to fall behind again. There we go. So, I want to see... how do ASD people to lead, pretend, and make believe? And it's different for everybody, right? That we know some people who are on the spectrum that get very caught up in their own world. They're actually very good at the pretend and the make believe. They just don't know how to weave it into being social, right? So we know kids that will sit there and they have a whole inner world that's going on that's so reinforcing to them, they don't want to talk to you, right? So it isn't always that the problem is that they don't know how to make believe or pretend. Then there are other kids that are on the opposite end of the spectrum that are so rule oriented that they don't allow themselves to fantasize or go into it could be something else. And for those kids, what we outlined very specifically today, really helpful, because then you can teach them, okay, this is what the rules around this are. For the kids who are locked in their own little world, it becomes incumbent to get down on the floor with them and become a part of their world and to see if they'll welcome you into their world. And we do that by modeling, you know, for kids like that, I keep my movements very little, but if I have a kiddo that's busy doing their own thing, I show them what I'm doing. And I watch what they're doing, And if they're playing with the car and I keep my energy really contained, right? And I might bring my little thing over and interact with their car. And I will see that suddenly they like the fact that this bobblehead does this. And now they want to do the bobblehead thing. And so I let them do the bobblehead thing. And now we're in this space, this bubble of imagination together. And it's really incumbent upon me to listen. And I start a conversation that's play. Sometimes with kids, I will just... And you know, they keep doing their thing. And then I go back to... in a rhythm, right? Until eventually they'll come over and they'll go... and I go, oh. And then I go... and then they'll go... and we start a conversation. So it's creating a bubble where they'll let you in. And once you're in, I mean, I think it's something about having respect for their space and not forcing yourself in. But when you get invited in, you come in as a good guest, and a guest brings things with them. It's not, you know, I love to have it be directed by the child, but and we want to be listening to what the child is saying, but we can bring things in too and make little tap noises. And see, or sometimes I'll just do something with my finger, or sometimes I've got pen all over my hand today. But sometimes with kids, I will say high five, and a lot of kids, you know, they know that and they, oh, high five. And then I go, wait, here's your change. And I do that and they're like, what is that? And then I go high five again and I say, give me some change. And they're like, and then they do that. And then we start the conversation that way. So, lots of different things. Parker says, go noodle. I have friends that are teachers. Jack Hartman is another great resource. I don't know that. Somebody says, thanks. I'm from Korea. I watched Doc. We love your TV. Can I tell you? I'm so hooked on Korean TV. I watched Dr. Doreen's live yesterday. I have been awake since 2 here to watch Autism Live. I'm so glad that you're here with us. And please let us know if you have specific questions, okay? And then Dark Angel says, how to teach how to put sentences together. Okay, so let's talk about that. So I can use play to do that. Even before we started ABA, we had a therapist who, you know, she was doing some ABA techniques and some play therapy, who would come to our house, and she had this great toy that... it was like something we'd seen on Baby Einstein. You can find the kind of toy that it is on Discovery Toys. But it's sort of this ball thing where you put the ball down and it goes down the thing. But it's for little kids, big balls, right? And so she would put him in the high chair. He was that little. And she would set the toy on the high chair and she would take out the ball and she would say, ball. And then she would take the ball and she would let it go down and he would... grab the ball because it's very exciting, and then you know she would say to him ball, right? And in the beginning she wasn't forcing him to say anything, right? And she would point to her lips and she would say ball, right? So eventually we got to the point where she would hold up the ball and she would say ball, and she would get him to approximate by either saying buh or buh or ball. Or some version of ball, and if he would, she would give him the ball, right? And then he would get to put it down the thing, and it was all, that was his reinforcer, right? But it had to be something he was interested in. At that point, he was interested in the ball, and she made it interesting, right? So now you got one word, great. And now it's pizza dough, you wanna stretch it out. So, and this doesn't happen overnight. This is why ABA takes so many hours, because it's like everything else in life. We're going to change slowly, like a plant grows slowly. We're not trying to do it overnight. So she would come and play with him, and that would be just one of the many things that they would do. But then the next time she would come back, she would either teach him sign. Do you want more ball? I think this is more, right? It's this how old I am now, how far away. She would say, you know, do you want more ball? And she would language it, and she would do the sign at the same time. So he could either sign or say more ball, right? Just the approximation, not even doing the more, but more ball. But then eventually he could say more ball. And then she taught him more ball, please. And by that time we were in ABA and And they took that and ran with it because she would come, like 2-3 hours a week, right? And so we only got to ball before, and maybe the sign for more before she left. But then ABA came in, and in the beginning, they were there for 25 hours a week while we fought to get funding to get to 40 hours a week. And by 6 months into ABA, we got to 40 hours a week. But so now they were in there and they were like, okay, now we're going to play pirates. And now, okay, we're going to run over here. And what, you know, I've got this. Do you want it? And my son would go to grab the ball and they'd go, what is it? It's a b. And he'd say ball. And then very quickly, within like a week, they taught him more ball, please. Then it was want more ball, please. Then I want more ball, please. Now we've got a sentence. I want more ball, please. And then you just continue on with that. So I want more ball, please. And then they would either ask him a question or they would say, what are you going to do with the ball? Are you going to throw it? Whatever. So that then he would say, I want more ball, please. I'm going to throw it. Right. And they would heavily reinforce that. But then you have to teach back and forth, which is the conversation thing. So then we would take a ball and we literally started with a ball and we would sit on the floor. And I, you know, and the therapist would do this with him and I would do this with him. So we'd sit on the floor and because he liked balls. If your child isn't into balls, you don't do this, right? But they would roll the ball and they would say, my name is Peter. And he would get the ball and he would roll back and he'd go, my name is Jem. And then Peter would roll it back and he'd go, I like Batman. And then Jem would roll it back and say, I like, you know, Mickey Mouse, right? And so it's kind of prompting, but eventually it was questions. It was, and they taught him, so he, you know, and eventually there wasn't a ball, but it was the back and forth that they had sort of built into his repertoire. So Peter would say to him, hey, how was your day today? And he would say, you know, my day was good. And then Peter would go, like that to prompt him, and Jem would like have to think about it for a minute. He'd go, how was your day, Peter? Right? And Peter would go, dude, thanks for asking. My day was great. I went to the movies last night. What did you do last night? And then it would go back and forth, and Jem would be like, I, you know, went to the park. And then Peter would go, and then Jem would have to ask him another question. And they would see how many volleys they would get back and forth. Now, in the beginning, there was only one volley back and forth, but then it was two. And I remember I used to have to fill out the Vineland, and they would say how many, I don't think the word was volley, but how many back and forth conversations. And there was like, can your child do two? And I remember the day that I was like, oh, I can check that off. He can now. And then it was, can they do three? Can they do four? Can they do more than seven? And I remember the day that I was like, yeah, he can definitely do more than seven. That took maybe 2 years of intensive. This is why I'm saying it's a lot of hours. A lot of hours. So my four-year-old knows so many flashcards, but he can't put the sentence together. Yes, this is the problem with when we're teaching language. It's just one of the steps. Like I just told you the four steps of play, four of the steps for play. In this book, there is a curriculum for language. And you don't just teach labels, which a lot of people just teach labels. But with language, we're talking about the language operants then, Dark Angel. And it's in here somewhere. I'm not gonna go through the whole book to find. But when we teach language, we need to teach both the expressive and the receptive form of whatever. So if I'm teaching pen, I want you to be able to express that it's a pen in whatever way that you can, because some people that's verbal and some people it's not. But when I say to you, what is it? You need to be able to hold up a card and say it's a pen. You need to vocally be able to say it's a pen, or you need to be able to type it's a pen or hit the icon it's a pen, because you're able to say it's a pen, right? So that is the expressive, that you can say that it's a pen. And then there's the receptive, that when I say pen, when I say get me the pen, you know what I'm talking about. And you have to teach both sides of everything in the beginning. Eventually, kids will get it, but that's like another year and a half, right? So we don't just teach labels. We have to teach the label expressively and receptively, but then we want to make sure that we're doing all the verbal operants. So we're going to start with a echoic, that you can just echo it. That I say it's a pen, you say it's a pen. You may not even understand that it's a pen at that point, but that if I, it's imitation. It's pure imitation in whatever way that you can. But then we're going to work on to matching. That I, maybe I have two, a pen, and I've got a pen and a pencil. I say put with same. And that you can match a pen with a pen because it's important that you understand, you know, what it is, and you can match the two of them together. Then we're going to work on, there's a whole series of things, and am I going to remember what all of them are? So there's matching, then later on we're going to work on being able to tact a pen, which is being able to come up with the word pen in a new circumstance where pen has not been said to label it. It's hard to explain, but the example that I always give is if your child is in some place and let's say that a balloon floats in and they go, oh, balloon, that's tacting. I didn't say balloon, I didn't mention balloon, and they brought it into the conversation to let you know that there's a balloon there. That's pure tacting, right? And then interverbals is when where you want to get, where I can start to have a conversation with you and I can say to you, what do you want to write with today? And I didn't say pen, but you have so many things in your brain that you can choose from that you can request a pen. You can say, I want a blue pen, and nobody said anything about a blue pen. But in order to get to that point, you have to have all the labels, but then there's a whole lot of lessons that have to come in till you can get to that point. And they're all in this book. And, you know, there it's probably 1,000 lessons, Dark Angel. And a lot of times people think, well, if I take my child to speech an hour a week, we're going to work on those labels and it's great. We're doing something. You're not wrong, but it's not the whole thing. And what we see when they only get the speech part is exactly that. They can label, but they can't have a conversation. And that's heartbreaking because the facility is there. We just haven't taught it. So I would tell you, ABA, and I know you're in Canada and it's hard, but you know, get the book and read the section on language and ask us questions and we'll help you to get there. It's hard to do it by yourself. I'm not going to say that it isn't, but it's not impossible, and other people have. You can, and he's already demonstrated, your child has already demonstrated that they can speak, they have the facility to speak, and they have the ability to remember things. They've got one of the brickwork things, they just don't know how to use it. It would be like giving somebody a car and not teaching them how to drive. We don't want to do that. Nowhere to teach ASD Junior ABA Therapy in here. Doctor, Shannon was also ASD boy mom who encouraged me to learn ABA therapy for my boy. Well, I hope that you'll stick with us here and learn what you can. None of us, when on our first day, even the best therapist, there was a day when they didn't know how to do ABA. Even the best one. So we have to be willing to say, I don't know, but I'm willing to learn. And there's lots of places. Traven, do we have the address for the Autism Partnership? Because they have online training that you can do for free. If you go to their website and register for their RBT training for free, it will teach you all kinds of things about ABA. All kinds of things. And then if you take that and use the lessons that are here in this book, you know, or get skills, you'd be good. Hi, Letty. We're getting close to we're way past the end of the show here. Could you introduce ABA programs for ASD Junior or online ABA programs? I was deeply let down to register no ABA center for my son, but since knowing Autism Live, I've gotten a beam of light. Yeah, so that Autism Partnership, I think that Traven's probably looking it up right now. But if you just Google Autism Partnership RBT free training, you'll find it. And it's free online. And if that ever changes, please, everybody tell me because I keep promoting it. Letty says, I will be working with a child that his problem is tantrum behavior. I think probably tantrum is what you're saying. How can I help him to reduce this behavior? So tantrums happen when someone can only get their needs met by throwing a tantrum or because they are 100% sure that their needs are not going to be met. That is why people tantrum. It is not random behavior. I will say this. It also can happen if they are uncomfortable, right? It's behavior. It's communication. They're telling you, it's not going my way. I'm not happy, and it's not going my way. And if we can give someone functional communication where they have the hope of being able to communicate their needs and say, what I need right now is a glass of water. There's the autismpartnershipfoundation.org. Check that out, you guys. Go to the button that says free RBT training. But if we can teach functional communication to someone, and everyone has the right to functional communication. It's going to look different for different people. For some people, that's going to mean, I say to you, stop, you're hurting me. For other people, it might be touching a thing on an iPad that speaks for me or another AUG device that speaks for me. It might mean holding up a card that has a symbol on it that says stop, right? It might mean sign language, right? It might mean a gesture saying, no, I don't want this, right? But until we give this individual the ability to communicate their needs, they're going to tantrum. And we have to allow our mind to go, this is not the problem. The problem is not the tantrum. I'm sure it is in the moment in school, but the problem is this person doesn't have another way to tell me what they need. They're telling me something. So if you watch, we've done lots of shows on the fact that we try to figure out what the function of the behavior, what is it that the child is trying to tell you? If the child is trying to tell you, I need a break, then what we do is not in the moment of the tantrum, but outside of the tantrum, we teach them how to ask for a break, and we honor it when they ask for a break, right? If they're trying to tell you, I need my water bottle, my throat is hurting and I need my water bottle. I don't want, you know, I math is happening, but I want my water bottle. Then outside, not during the tantrum, but outside of the tantrum, we teach them how to ask for their water bottle. And when they need their water bottle, we give it to them. And we see that when kids are able to do that, when they need a drink, they drink and then they go right back to the math, right? It might be that they're tantruming because nobody's paying attention to them. And if they had a way to say, hey, I need for you to pay attention to me right now, they wouldn't need to tantrum. So when we see that it's that there's an attention deficit, then what we do is we give them attention on a regular basis, which means we give them feedback. And, you know, I know teachers that have a little watch alarm that buzzes sometimes every 2 minutes. And every 2 minutes, they'll say to the kiddo who needs the attention, Bobby, you're doing great. And you know what? Bobby doesn't tantrum all day because he's getting what he needs, right? And then the last main reason why people do, because I just went through them, people do something because they need a break or to escape something. And I went through the one that they need access to someone or something and attention. And the last one is because it's automatically reinforcing. You know, people do a lot of things, and I won't say that no one ever tantrums because it's automatically reinforcing, but I think it's the rare case. Sometimes, though, they will tantrum to get control on the situation because if I really don't like what's happening and I don't have any way to stop it, I can throw a tantrum and it gets in your way. And then I have a little bit more control over the situation. It's really important that we give everyone, even little babies, choices. That we don't give them any fait accomplis, that we say to them, do you want to do this or do you want to do this? Even if they don't really love either one of the choices, we need to give them choices. How would you feel if you went through your whole day and people just motored you through the whole day and you got no say in it and you couldn't say to anybody, I need to go to the bathroom. I need a drink. Can I have a break? I'm a little overloaded right now. Think about if you had no facility to get your needs met, I would tantrum, wouldn't you? I would be throwing the biggest tantrum. I have thrown tantrums. The famous one is that I threw a tantrum in a Dick's Sporting Goods because my husband and my child were not listening to me. And I had already asked the person working there. I was like, the music is so loud. Can you please turn the music down? And they were like, no, it's wired that way. And there's not. And nobody was listening to me. And then eventually I just said, you know what? Forget it. And I laid down on the floor, and my husband was like, oh, my God, what's happening? Do we need to call an ambulance? And I said, no, I'm done with all of you. I'm going to lay here. And the guy came over, and he's like, what's wrong? And I said, I'm having sensory overload, and so I'm going to lay here. You couldn't turn down the music. I'm going to lay here on your floor. And he was like, well, you can't lay on the floor. And I was like, what are you going to do? Pick me up? Carry me out? I threw a tantrum because nobody was listening to me, and I had no control. But I had control over the fact that I could lay down on the floor. And I was like 48 when I did that. And I'm fully verbal. I still wasn't getting my needs met. And nobody was listening to me. So a four-year-old, of course they're going to go to that. Of course they're going to lay down on the floor. Don't get overwhelmed by it. When they're in the middle of the tantrum, it's really important to make sure that they can't hurt themselves or anybody else. Do not lecture them. Do not give a whole bunch of attention to the tantrum. This is a fine line. We don't want to ignore the child, but we do want to ignore behavior that we don't want to see flourish. If you would like to see tantrums on a regular basis, by all means, talk to them endlessly, because then what they learn is, oh, when I throw a tantrum, I have your undivided attention. I think I'll do it every day. Let's schedule a meeting. Shall we do that at 11:15 every day? Works for me. We don't want that. Kadra says, my son is 4 years old and he has autism. I have been trying to toilet train him, but I have been having trouble. Do you have any tips? There's something called the Fox and Azrin method. And I would encourage you to look it up. It's found to be the effective method. And basically what it says is that we all have a number. You have a number, I have a number. I drink a bunch of liquid, and there's a certain amount of minutes before I'm going to need to use the restroom. I did not know this before we potty trained my son. I didn't know that we all have a number. I didn't even know this about myself. But what we want to do is set ourselves up for success. So the first things that you do in the Fox and Azrin is that you make the bathroom, you pick a bathroom to be the bathroom to start, and you make it as reinforcing as possible. That there are some toys that are only in the bathroom. Maybe there, for my son, we had a little portable DVD player that was only in the bathroom. That's the only place it ever was. And that if he went into the bathroom, he could watch the cartoons. He only liked black and white cartoons. I don't know. The colorful ones were too much color for him. I don't know. And there were books in there, and it was cozy and wonderful and all the colors that he liked. And we modeled the behavior, and we would say, I'm going to the bathroom, and showed him that we enjoyed going to the bathroom, that it was not a place to be afraid of. And we also started giving him drinks and keeping a chart and keeping track of so that we could sort of get a beat on what his number was. So, you know, we'd give him a big old cup of water or, you know, his favorite drink, whatever your kiddo likes, and we would check the time, and then we would see when he soiled the diaper. And we did that for like 2 weeks to get a baseline. Okay, now you know the number, and you might know that the number for your child is 22 minutes. And on average, you give your child liquid, and around 22 minutes later, they're probably going to need to do the bathroom. So you subtract a few minutes from whatever that number is, and you start boot camp. After you've made the bathroom reinforcing and you got your number and you did the baseline on it, you're going to buy some snazzy new underwear and you're going to put them in a shirt and the underwear, and you're going to have a stack of the underwear and you're going to plan on doing laundry later. But you put the diapers away. And you have a timer, and you get their favorite salty snack, and you eat the salty snacks, and then you go, here's the liquid, and they want the salty snack, and then they want the liquid because they ate the salt, and you set the timer for 5 minutes less than whatever the magic number is, maybe 4 minutes, I don't know. check with Fox Nazarin. So, and you play games and you do other things and you really don't have anything else on your schedule for a couple of days to do boot camp, right? And then the timer goes off, and when the timer goes off, you go, oh, it's time to go to the bathroom, and you do whatever song that you do, and everybody parades off to the bathroom, and we pull the fancy schmancy underwear down, and they go on the toilet, and we set the timer, and Fox and Aswin will tell you exactly, it's like 4 minutes that you set the timer, because we don't want them to sit there forever and have their little legs go to sleep. It won't be reinforcing, right? And they sit there on the toilet, and we do other things, and we have a good time, and we read books, and we watch cartoons, we do whatever is reinforcing to them in the bathroom, and should they tinkle in the toilet, we celebrate and we go, what a great job. You're such a big girl. You're such a big boy. Oh my goodness. Whatever is meaningful to them, we give them hugs, kisses, rewards. We go, dude, you did it. Whatever is appropriate. And we wash up and we go do something else fun. Should we go do something fun? And you do that again and again and again. A lot of times they won't tinkle on the toilet because it's performance anxiety and they don't tinkle on the toilet and we don't make a big deal about that. The timer goes off and they haven't tinkled on the toilet and we go, okay, all done. And we still wash our hands, but we just don't have the big party. We don't go, you didn't go. We don't do that to them. That's shaming. It has no place in the Fox and Aswin, right? But we go, okay, that's fine. And we're going to wash our hands, but it's distinctly different. It's not the big party, right? And we go back to doing the fun stuff, but we set the timer now for 3 more minutes or whatever it is. I don't remember what the Fox and Aswin numbers are. But then when the timer goes off again, we go, time to go to the bathroom again! And we keep doing that until one of two things happens. Either they tinkle in the toilet or they have an accident. And when they have an accident, it's not a big deal. We take off the underwear, it goes into the laundry pile. We don't, no recriminations, no shame, nothing. We don't talk about it. We just deal with it. We help them to wipe themselves up. We put a fresh pair on and we start the salty snacks and we just rinse and repeat and we start all over again. We never try to make it anything aversive, right? It's all good or like nothing. You know, there's no yakking at them about, you know, you're supposed to do that in the potty, honey. don't, that's not helpful, right? We big reward when they tinkle in the potty, and should they poop in the potty, oh my gosh, right? Then we just like, it's the best thing ever. But we keep doing that. And usually, even kids on the spectrum, if we do this for 3 or 4 days, they get into a rhythm and you get into a rhythm. And then you want to, as quickly as you can, move it to another toilet that maybe you have to go to grandma's house to use the toilet, because we don't want them to get fixated on the fact that it only happens in that toilet. We do put, and you always pack a bag and put it in the car with extra pants and extra, you know, whatever underwear you have, and you go to Target and you have your timer set. You're gonna do the timer thing for probably a few weeks until we're 100% solid and the child starts requesting. And we start to say, you know, when the timer goes off, it's time to go to the bathroom. Don't you have to go to the bathroom? Let's go to the bathroom. You know, tell me however they tell you, you know, it's time to go to the bathroom. So you build that into it. But it doesn't fail, except when the child's not ready. So let's say you do this for 3 or 4 days and you really are nowheresville and you're not really being sick, and be honest with yourself. Did you follow the timer? Did you follow all the instructions? Because if you do and you reinforced it enough, if the child is ready, it will sink in. If it didn't, it means the child wasn't ready. That's not their fault. It's not your fault. And it's not Fox and Aswin. We go, okay, the child's body isn't ready yet. So we take a break from it and we come back in a month or two and try again. And we go, you know, there are people who tell you, you know, you don't ever go back to the diapers. If they're not ready, you go back to the diapers, right? But when you're trying it, no diapers. We want them to feel the sensation of, oh, I'm wet. And we don't leave them to sit in the wet. We clean them up immediately, and there's no recriminations about it. There's no lectures. There's no discussion. There's no faces. There's no disappointment. Nothing. It's a nothing burger. We just, you know, it just like if you, you know, are doing pajamas, although sometimes when you do pajamas, it's hugs and everything. Okay. We're going to have to stop this in a minute, although you guys are still writing things in. When my son was at the age 4 to 6, he started tantrum More than six times a day. My family was hard to overcome. One friend who has ADHD boy, she introduced us to doctors, and I went to the doctor. The doctor advised medicine for my son. My son has taken pills. After taking pills, he's hardly started the tantrum. I don't know what the pills are, and I don't know... when he was tantruming, he was telling you something. Now, the tantrum might have been, I don't feel good. I have a tummy ache. In which case, if you gave them medicine, then yes, that might be a reason why the tantrums would stop. So absolutely, you know, sometimes the communication that they're giving is, I don't feel well. And it's always important to be talking to doctors and checking to make sure is something that's happening because of a medical reason. And I think that gets overlooked with kids with autism all the time, as if they can't have stomach aches. As you know, some of our kids, they find out later on that they have stomach ulcers that they didn't know, right? Kids with autism can have all kinds of things going on, just like kids that don't have autism, right? So, yeah, absolutely, you know. But it's always communication. Even then, he was communicating, I don't feel well. So it's all good. But do, you know, make pediatricians listen to you. I love you all. We've gone on way longer than I had intended, but it was great. We are back tomorrow with our Halloween show for Let's Talk Autism with Shannon and Nancy. My friend Nancy Allspot Jackson will be joining me. We've got a great guest, a mom who is a tour de force. You're going to love her. A former lawyer and then has a house full of kids. And she's going to talk to us about some of her path and her journey, and we'll look forward to hearing from her about that. So, and we'll have in the news, and it will be fantastic, and wait till you see who Nancy and I are dressing up as. Dark Angel, I am sending you such a big hug. I want you to know your child can have conversation. It's going to take many, many, many hours. But your child can have conversation. If they can label that many things, it's just a matter of working on it, and it takes time. Okay? I am sending you all hugs. We'll see you tomorrow. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me and a big one for you too. Bye-bye for now.